Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. Good evening. And this is our fifth episode. Glad to be on the air and also on the show. But let's start out. Hey, Lynn, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. How are you yourself?
I'm great.
This is our fifth installment, and we're still feeling kind of anxious before showtime. Looking through papers and then having our hands kind of get sweaty, at least mine is.
It's pretty exhilarating, for sure.
So tonight, what are we talking about? anxiety?
Speaking of, yep. So tonight, our discussion will be titled Symptoms, Causes, and Treatment of PTSD. The guest tonight will be covering most of that. Her background is here and currently working in that area. Let's start off then by talking about her. Our guest tonight, her name's Christy Driscoll. She is a licensed independent social worker in private practice with over 25 years of experience. She's the owner of Defining Step Counseling and has developed a highly successful 8-week smoking cessation program for anyone wanting to quit smoking. With a mission to bring counseling to those needing help, Christy has made her practice available via telephone or internet in an attempt to make therapy a more affordable and accessible.
So, Christy, how are you doing tonight?
Well, I'm thrilled to be here tonight, Lynn. And are you able to hear me okay?
Loud and clear. Everybody, hopefully, if anybody's out there, let us know if you are having some issues in hearing us. Our live call-in number is 347-677-0699. Please press 1 to actually talk to the host, Mia or Aaron. If you don't, we're just going to assume that you are listening to the show.
Besides, we'll be talking to with our guest for about 30 minutes with Christy, and we'll be also featuring a few clips from NPR News. The first one dealing with war vets and how they use mixed martial arts therapeutically to help with their PTSD. Second clip will be PTSD in teens, focusing on the dynamic between boys and girls, more so in girls than boys. And then thirdly, PTSD in emergency personnel, which we don't always remember, police.
Blog Talk
and
Radio.
Whoa, what happened to her? I have no idea what just happened. Oh, it's doing it again like last time. Anyway, what we need to do now is just basically not listen to ourselves talk. And that's the problem, is we're going to have some issues here. We're having some technical difficulty right now with Blog Talk Radio. It's actually repeating what just happened 5 minutes ago. It's going to be difficult to hear ourselves think. This happened to me 2 weeks ago. Here's what's going to happen. Christy, I know you can hear me, but we've actually have the our laptop on mute. Anything you say right now will probably be heard, but we won't be able to hear you. I'm trying to figure out a way to fix this. So while we're trying to fix this, we're going to listen to the first NPR clip about MMA used therapeutically with our war vets. Here we go.
Two long wars have left a legacy of psychological wounds among those who served. Just consider this number. half a million veterans have made benefit claims with the VA for post-traumatic stress disorder. Hundreds of thousands more who served in Iraq and Afghanistan are expected to file in the next year. There are treatments, the most common involving medication and talk therapy, and then there are ways of coping that those suffering from PTSD come up with on their own. Samara Freemar reports on one of them.
Once every month, Kyle Dubé drives to the Spartan Academy gym in a dusty strip mall in Tempe, Arizona, to meet up with his mixed martial arts team.
Hey, what's up, man? How you doing, brother?
Dubé was a combat army medic in Iraq. He did three tours during some of the worst fighting of the war, and many of the guys he's meeting tonight are also combat veterans. They're here for a fight night.
Am I going against you?
I know, man.
Mixed martial arts is a cross between kickboxing and wrestling, 2 minutes of often bone-snapping, teeth-crunching brawls, and Dubé's got the list of injuries to prove it.
See, I got an open dislocation of my finger. I tore my MCL. I've broken a rib, broken my nose, popped my shoulder out the other night. Everybody makes fun of me because I just get hurt all the time.
That's what Kyle's known for.
But Kyle Dubé also has pain that's less visible. After his second tour in Iraq, he was diagnosed with PTSD. He suffered from insomnia, depression, anxiety, flashbacks. He slept with a loaded pistol on his nightstand and an assault rifle under his bed. He says he was always angry.
You feel it just spreading into your arms, into your fingers. Your pulse starts just racing, and you just want to scream. And I didn't know how to get rid of it.
First he tried whiskey, then he tried bar brawls. And then he did what the experts tell you to. He asked for help. Not easy for someone coming from the bruising world of the battlefield. Dubé took his meds, and he went to therapy, which helped him a lot. But it wasn't a total fix. Dubé says there was still this bad energy inside him, and he dealt with that the day he first walked into the Spartan Academy and started fighting.
I felt better, I felt happier, less stress, less anxiety. I felt great.
Mixed martial arts isn't a replacement for other therapies. It's a coping mechanism, Dubé's own personal way to make himself whole. Tonight, Dubé is fighting Justin Hayes, a vet who did a tour in Iraq as a Marine sniper. Hayes is scheduled for a PTSD assessment, but in the meantime, while he waits, nights like tonight work for him.
Hanging out with friends, beating the crap out of each other, nothing more fun than that. You got drama at home, you got school, you got homework, but when you're on the mat, nothing matters. You know, everybody has their own different way to cope with things, and I guess fighting's mine.
All right, Dan, you got the lineup?
Yeah.
Dubé and Hayes enter the ring. They shake hands, the buzzer sounds, and they go at it, kicking, punching, wrestling, strangling. They look like they're trying to kill each other. Jeff Funicello is the coach here, and he says no matter how violent this all looks, what's going on is actually kind of
therapeutic. You know, I think it's just therapeutic for him.
He says he's seen it again and again in the veterans who've passed through his doors over the last decade.
This is clearly not for everybody. I mean, who wants to do this? These guys are nuts. But when they're in here, you find a way to put order to something that's disorderly. The anxiety, that buildup, boom, it goes away. And I think overcoming that makes them feel good.
Spartan Academy isn't the only mixed martial arts group working with veterans struggling with PTSD. There's another one in San Diego. Joe Westermeyer is a psychiatrist at the VA Medical Center in St. Paul. And while he's careful to say that mixed martial arts is decidedly not therapy, it could be therapeutic.
Part of PTSD involves a loss of control. And so what I think people are doing is they're exposing themselves to a fear, and then trying to re-exert that sense of being in control of themselves.
The match ends. Hayes and Dubé leave the mat.
Pretty well gassed. That was a good fight, dude.
Tired.
I'm hurting. My arms hurt.
Tonight, they'll leave the gym with scrapes and strains and bruises, but they'll take with them some hard-won peace of mind. For NPR News, I'm Samara Freemark.
And this story was produced in association with the Public Insight Network.
Okay, so we've sort of fixed the situation. We're no longer going to be using the Skype. For some reason, when we log on to Skype, there's a delay, and then 5 minutes later or 10 minutes later, it replays the beginning of it, and then it becomes an echo after that. So it was really difficult to talk and think. Did I just say that?
Yeah.
So do apologize for that. Let's talk about the next clip is actually another NPR clip concerning about PTSD with teens. Apparently, they're very difficult to diagnose in teens. Although what they know so far, there's about 4% of boys who are diagnosed with PTSD and about 6% of girls who are diagnosed with PTSD. And we'll talk more about that with Christy later on, but here's the clip.
We tend to hear about post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, in relation to war veterans, but many sufferers here at home haven't yet finished high school. According to the National Survey of Adolescents, about 4% of teenage boys and 6% of teenage girls meet the clinical definition of PTSD, though adolescents can be hard to diagnose. Iyama Harris from Youth Radio reports on young people living with PTSD.
On the night of Stephanie Romero's 23rd birthday, she and her friend were attacked by a stranger.
My friend went outside to go have a cigarette, and there was this guy. He came out. He was harassing us. And
Stephanie says the man hit her and her friend. She was shocked.
It was just a total nightmare. I think about it all the time, and I've never gone through anything like that.
After the attack, Stephanie's friends and family noticed she was acting differently. She didn't go out as often. Her weight started changing. She was really depressed. Later, doctors diagnosed her with post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD.
Like PTSD, I thought it was just for veterans, but I found out it's not. It's for anybody who's experienced any kind of event where you can't get it out of your mind. It takes over your life, and that's kind of what happened to me.
I can relate. When I was 15, my mom was murdered. I tried everything I could to deal with my feelings, including writing songs.
Dry my tears and kiss me goodnight.
But still, something was different about me. I noticed that I didn't feel like my normal self anymore, not only mentally, but physically. I was losing weight and my hair was falling out.
That's a pretty clear symptom that something is not going well.
Jamal Harris is a pediatrician at a community health center in San Francisco. He says he sees teens with PTSD at his clinic all the time, and that many of them have physical symptoms related to their stress.
Some examples of symptoms, especially in teens, will be problem sleeping, weight gain, and just being frustrated.
It turns out a lot of those changes are due to hormones your body makes in response to stress. This can be a good thing. For example, if a car comes at you all of a sudden while you're crossing the street, your body produces a chemical called cortisol, which helps you react fast enough to move before the car hits you. But for people with PTSD like Stephanie and me, it doesn't take a speeding car to set us off. In a lab at Stanford University, scientists are using a technology called functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, to study the emotional reactions of patients with PTSD.
So we know, for example, when they're faced with a reminder of their trauma, that they don't activate the circuitry that we normally associate with emotion regulation, the ability to be resilient in an automatic, effortless fashion.
That's the lead researcher, Dr. Amit Ekin. He says cortisol, that's the same stress hormone that causes physical changes in the body, may also be responsible for the changes in the brain.
Over time, elevated cortisol can cause death of neurons in the brain, the kind that don't get replaced.
But that doesn't mean PTSD can't be treated. Scientists know talk therapy can be helpful. Ekin wants to understand how that kind of therapy might be repairing emotional connections in the brain, and he's recruiting volunteers.
Great job, Stephanie. How are you doing?
Okay.
You're okay? Alrighty.
Stephanie Romero is one of the participants in Dr. Ekin's study. 10 months after her attack, she's still having trouble feeling safe.
It's always in my back of my head, like, you just never know, your life could change in like a blink of an eye. You know, you could one minute be celebrating your birthday, next you know you're in the hospital and you know you don't know how you ended up there.
In a room on the other side of a huge glass window, Stephanie lies in an fMRI machine, which looks like a big tube with a small hollow center. I sit in front of a monitor as Ekin shows me different angles of Stephanie's brain.
A lot of what we look at with emotion is focused on certain regions of the brain. One of them is the amygdala, which is really important not only for guiding your attention and focus on a threat stimulus, but also for affecting your body. But somebody with PTSD doesn't activate that circuitry well.
Dr. Ekin asked Stephanie several questions to help him identify which specific parts of the brain are affected by PTSD and how she feels throughout the experiment.
Does she feel in her body at the moment, or is she feeling, like many PTSD patients report, feeling a little out of body or detached or unreal?
I can relate to that unreal feeling. It started to hit me right there in the lab. Ekin hopes, by understanding how that feeling plays out inside the brain, scientists will be able to come up with better ways of treating this disorder, whether it's through singing, talking, neuroscience, or all of the above. For NPR News, I'm Yama Harris.
That story was produced by Youth Radio.
So that clip actually tells about a little bit more about the chemicals of cortisol, the use of it, of the body, in order for it to give us the extra oomph to get out of the way of a moving car if they're trying to hit you. But unfortunately, PTSD folks who suffer from PTSD have that going on all the time. The third clip is about people and first responders who are basically, that's their job, to constantly be in the line of fire sometimes, or at the aftermath, helping up with the aftermath. So here's the clip from that one. And again, it's about over five minutes long, but really, really good information.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Post-traumatic stress syndrome, or PTSD, is a condition closely associated with the battlefield. But Michael Ferrara developed PTSD without going to war. He spent 3 decades living and saving lives in Aspen, Colorado, as a search and rescue man. After several years, horrific images from those rescues started playing over and over in his mind. Therapy brought him back, and he joins us from Aspen Public Radio to talk about his case. Also joining us is writer Hampton Sides, who writes about Ferrara and the other rescuers who have had to cope with their own post-traumatic stress. And that article appears in the January issue of Outside Magazine. Welcome, Michael Ferrara.
Hello.
And Hampton Sides, who joins us from Santa Fe.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Michael, give us a description of what triggered your PTSD.
You know, it's really hard to pinpoint an event or time. For 30 years, I've been a ski patrolman, cop, paramedic, firefighter, and little by little, it just started to build. And then one day, the slideshow that was all these events started running in my head, and I couldn't control it.
Can you give us a sense of what are the kinds of things you were seeing?
Oh, my. Yes. An eviscerated man from an automobile crash, a burned, dismembered bodies, climbers who had fallen 2,000 feet. It's really hard to come up on the body of a good friend.
That happened to you at one point?
It's happened to me numerous times. The last one was a very close friend of mine in December of 2008 who had been killed in an avalanche. I was at bottom at that point.
How did you handle it?
I isolated. I didn't leave the house. And I had begun using Percocet that had been prescribed for physical ailments for my emotional trauma.
Now, Hampton, Michael's not alone in this experience, and you write about this idea of civilian PTSD among first responders like fire, police, and mountain rescue people. Is there any way to do that job without encountering this?
Well, it's just only recently become apparent that PTSD is rampant in the community of first responders, and I think maybe the last community that has come to recognize this has been these mountain communities who, you know, these people who essentially get to do what they love to do. And yet they come across this trauma and they see these horrible things, often people that they know. There's also the kind of the He-Man quality to this. These guys, most of them, and Michael included, he's a tough dude. He's a macho guy, and he is, and he wouldn't tell you that. But these guys don't like to recognize when they're hurting.
Michael, describe some of the therapies you did in order to heal yourself.
First of all, I didn't heal myself. I had a lot of professional help. Part of the things we did was got me to focus, instead of, there's a saying, I don't know how many people I've saved, I only remember the ones I've lost, to start looking at the saves I had.
Hampton, with more and more focus in the medical community on PTSD, on soldiers, what does that mean for wider use of these kinds of therapies for civilians?
Well, I think it's going to become much more widespread. Part of it is just educating people. And the paramedics and the ski patrollers, after an incident on the mountain, will have these debriefing sessions where they'll talk a little bit about it. And that's usually all they do. But now I think more and more people are beginning to recognize the first symptoms, things that you can do preventively. And I think that now, with the lead that the Veterans Administration has given us in terms of dealing with and talking about this condition, now it's okay for first responders and all other situations to come forward and to try to deal with it before it becomes acute, like it did in Michael's case.
This is Michael. I had a very interesting case a number of years ago. A young man riding his motorcycle on a mountain road, hit by an 18-wheeler. He was conscious when I got there, begging me not to let him die. He died on me, in my arms. And I talked to a psychologist afterwards, and she said, how are you doing? I said, oh, I'm fine. She goes, why would you be fine? You just had a man beg for his life, die in your arms. Why would you be fine after that? And we have to recognize that having this stuff mess with your head is not abnormal. You're not supposed to see stuff like this. And what we need to do is break through the culture by someone like myself stepping up and saying, hey, it happened to me, and I'm going to ask you, are you okay?
Michael Ferrara, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having us here.
And Hampton Sides, thank you.
Good to be here.
The article on rescue workers and PTSD is in the January issue of Outside Magazine.
So there you have it. The three clips from NPR News dealing with PTSD.
So let's begin with our first question for Christy tonight. What is PTSD? It's very, very generic, and let's find out what it's all about.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me tonight. I have worked with people who've had post-traumatic stress disorder throughout my career as a counselor, and we are just now really being able to understand what happens in the brain because of the functional MRIs that are able to, take a look at what's actually happening. So the brain is still a vast mystery to us counselors in many ways, but we're unraveling it. But what we do know about post-traumatic stress disorder is that it is an anxiety disorder. And what you all said earlier, the fight-or-flight mechanism that is there to protect us in case of a traumatic or dangerous event gets damaged or stuck. And so once that happens, there are some biochemical changes in the brain, some responses that happen that, the first response, the fight-or-flight response, is a healthy reaction meant to protect a person from harm, but when this is changed or damaged, then people feel stressed or frightened even when they're no longer in danger. And so that's sort of a brief description of what it is. Not all people get post-traumatic stress disorder after a traumatic experience, but it is a normal response to a traumatic event and, to have some sort of stress response. And so I want to normalize a lot of our reactions to things because, it only becomes a problem when it is prolonged over time. And so a lot of our responses are very normal to, like, you know, like the previous clip talked about, you know, we're not meant to observe trauma. You know, it's a shock to the system, and so we're going to have some reactions to it that we hope go away over a few weeks. And when they don't, that's when you have to look at whether there's a post-traumatic stress disorder happening. So I don't know if that answered your question, but that's sort of a brief description of it.
Okay. The thing that came up as a question for me while you were giving the definition or examples of PTSD is that as massage therapists, there are some people who get into car accidents, and I've been in one before, and for about several months, I'm very hyper-aware, and there seems to be like a feedback loop that I feed myself that if anybody gets too close, all of a sudden, I already think that they're trying to hit me, and so I act accordingly, and usually it's a bad decision.
Well, you know, there are some things that can, you know, that hypervigilance, that sort of, I've been in a car accident too, where it did take quite a while for me to pass this you know, where the event took place, where the accident took place, to be on hyper kind of alertness to other people's driving. And of course, we don't have control of other people's driving, so that exacerbates our sort of startle response to that. And, you know, recognizing that that is a fairly common response to an accident over time, but that, you know, there are some things that we'll talk about, you know, later on in the treatment of it that you can do to kind of mitigate those kind of automatic reactions that you have. And over time, they should dissipate. I don't know how long ago your accident was, but have you noticed that it has decreased over time at all?
Yeah, it has. I don't necessarily treat anybody close to me on my right side as about to sideswipe my car.
Uh-huh.
Although when I'm on my bike, my motorcycle, I do act as if everybody's out to get me. And that has gotten me, out of accidents.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, what we have found with post-traumatic stress disorder is that, and we will talk about that more when we talk about therapy and treatment, but what we say to ourselves about that accident and the motivations of the people, like using the words people out to get me, or, you know, how we represent that to ourselves can increase or decrease our anxiety about it. And so when we talk about cognitive behavioral therapy, which is often challenging our beliefs and what we're saying to ourselves about any given event, exacerbates or diminishes our emotional response when we think about that event, or when we're put in situations where that mimic it or somehow remind us that are kind of triggers. And what we say to ourselves about that definitely has an impact on how we respond to those triggers. And so we can talk about, you know, there are ways to kind of retrain your thinking about how you respond to those triggers that are going to be there no matter what. And but I did find for myself anyway that over time my startle response, particularly when it comes to driving and you have no control over other people's driving, you know, mm-hmm. that you do tend to be pretty hypervigilant about that for a while. And that's kind of a normal response when you think about it. You know, it's like, okay, I've discovered that I don't have control over this, and people can hit you. And so, you know, it's sort of a way that the organism is saying, hey, I'm on wake up call now. You know, these things can happen. My safety has been impinged upon a little bit. So, but I would think that. You know, that diminishes over time. And if it doesn't and it impinges on your ability to drive around, then you have to look at, you know, whether that's something that you want to talk to somebody about. Not you particularly, but anybody who might have that kind of response. So.
All right. Well, we've talked about, like, a few different sort of people that get PTSD, who would you say are victims of this? What kind of people, besides the ones we talked about, or have heard about so far?
Well, you know, of course, you know, the ones that we hear about the most are war veterans. And then, you know, unfortunately, there is a huge number of survivors of physical and sexual abuse. And even in the clips that we heard earlier talked about women more at risk for PTSD. And when you look at the statistics, there was a recent CDC survey that 1.3 million American women experienced a rape or attempted rape last year. That's a huge number of women. And so that, to me, that pretty much kind of accounts for why women are more at risk for post-traumatic stress disorder, because there is a higher rate of abuse, sexual abuse particularly. So that's a huge group that experiences post-traumatic stress. Teens, bully, you know, with our kind of shallow societies anymore, and then the rate of bullying in the schools, any kind of difference is subject to bullying, and that also can produce post-traumatic stress disorder. So teens are definitely a group that is experiencing it. The gay lesbian community, where kids are kicked out of their homes, where there's been either abuse because of their sexual orientation, where they're just kicked out or leave, run away because of the ongoing abuse, then they're put out on the streets and they are very vulnerable population to sexual abuse and predators and prostitution just as a means of survival on the streets. So that's another group that that definitely, you know, experiences a high rate of post-traumatic stress disorder. The clip also talked about the, you know, the care responders, the emergency care responders. I was talking to a fellow who is a radiology technician who dealt with emergency radiology patients that came in that were usually in a very extreme amount of pain. He was experiencing that kind of secondary trauma that was causing burnout, which I think is very similar to, you know, some of the post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. So, you know, he was definitely, you know, being exposed to that kind of thing. Caregivers, is surprisingly, even when you're taking care of an aging parent over time, or when a parent dies unexpectedly, or a family member. So those are also areas where trauma can set in, post-traumatic stress can set in. So those are just some of the examples that I know that I know that there are others that I'll forget. But those are some of the ones that come to mind the most.
What are the symptoms that are mostly associated with PTSD that you know of? I know everybody had, this is a normal response after a traumatic situation, but how do you know somebody's really suffering from PTSD?
Well, there's, you know, they group the symptoms into three different categories. And, you know, obviously what we're looking at is whether it impinges on one's ability to function in life. But the symptoms that we look at are, the first category is we call that the re-experiencing symptoms. And that can include flashbacks, reliving, you know, some traumatic event over and over again. It can also include things like physical symptoms, racing heart, sweating, shallow breathing, that kind of thing. We look at these re-experiencing symptoms of nightmares, bad dreams, frightening thoughts that just seem to come out of nowhere. These kinds of re-experiencing symptoms can cause problems in a person's everyday routine. They can also be self-created thoughts and feelings. You know, what we say to ourselves about things can create our experience about them. Words, objects, situations, the reminders of the event can also kind of trigger that re-experiencing symptoms. Like wherever your accident happened, driving by that place might trigger a response. Then we looked at the second category that we look at is sort of an avoidance, cluster of avoidance symptoms. And again, you know, not going by a place or event or, you know, anything that reminds you of the experience, staying away from it, feeling emotionally numb. There's certainly sometimes a very strong sense of guilt, like I could have done more to prevent an accident or I should have done more to save somebody, depression, just general worry, losing interest in activities that are enjoyable in the past, that kind of thing. And also just sort of, you know, disconnecting from remembering the dangerous or traumatic event in general. And there's a reason for that. The cortisol that gets flooded in the system, kind of disconnects our ability to recall things. So that's also a reason why that happens often, is we don't remember things very clearly right immediately after an event. But, you know, all of these avoidance symptoms can make you change your whole routine up, and it can be all-encompassing so that you're trying to avoid where the traumatic event happens. So that can be very disruptive. And then the third symptom that we look at, or the third cluster of symptoms that we look at, are the hyperarousal symptoms. And those are not really triggered by things. It's sort of an ongoing, consistent state of being that happens after a traumatic event. And that's where that fight or flight response gets kind of stuck in a high alert position, and we can talk about that for a minute too. It's the primitive brain has been put on alert, and so it's on high alert at all times, and so that's where that hyperarousal kind of comes from. So, you know, but it can really lead to a lot of stress and a lot of anger that just seems to erupt out of nowhere, a lot of impatience. Again, and it, you know, that really impacts the sleeping and eating and concentrating and being able to do your job and not, you know, snarl at the boss and that, you know, so that gets hard to work with for an employer too. So that's where holding down jobs with that on, feeling on edge all the time, it's difficult to maintain relationships with that. So, you know, some of these symptoms are always going to be fairly normal after a traumatic event. And so, you know, and so when we see these after that kind of event, we assume that it's a sort of an acute stress disorder that if it continues on and becomes an ongoing problem, then we have to consider that it's post-traumatic stress disorder. So, but, you know, again, one of the other things that happens is a lot of times the symptoms don't show up for weeks and months, you know, after the event. So, you know, and I've seen women who've been sexually abused that where they were able to kind of hold off all those symptoms for a long period of time, years, in fact, and then something triggered them, blindsided them, and all of a sudden they were experiencing post-traumatic PTSD symptoms. So, you know, that's not a hard and fast rule, but you know, if you educate yourself, you know, can begin to recognize. And there's also a lot of co-occurring kind of diagnosis like depression and substance abuse that also goes hand in hand with it. So all of that sort of has to be looked at and assessed and evaluated when you know, when somebody thinks that they have post-traumatic stress disorder. So there you go.
Well, the thing is that I'm also finding out with the research that I've done before this show came on, is that there's a lot of people that are suffering from PTSD who feel like they have everything in control, but they don't, and so they don't necessarily seek help. It's, as you said before, it does create, you know, chaos or in their life that they can't exactly work properly. Their work life basically goes out the door. They're having difficulty relating to their coworkers. Even at home, most definitely, they're having difficulties keeping the relationship intact. But most of these folks are really saying that they don't need help. You know, is that a little bit of like survivor's guilt, especially when it comes to the vets?
Well, the vets definitely have a culture that does not support mental health services. Although I was just hearing a statistic earlier, you know, that over a million vets are now claiming post-traumatic stress disorder, but there's not enough counselors to fill that need, and it's still, there's a culture of not seeking help, so I don't know what the disconnect is with that, but, you know, denial and repression of, you know, when we have experienced some trauma in our life, and we are not able to emotionally deal with it or look at it, or we go into that place of denial that or minimizing it so that we don't actually see what other people are seeing. And so vets are sort of a unique group of people. Men, you know, have to get over believing, you know, that it's not okay to talk about. You know, hey, I'm having some problems here. And, you know, so it's, you know, getting them to, from a place of I might have a problem because I think I have a problem versus I have a problem because somebody else says I have a problem. You know, that there are some ways of kind of motivating vets to start kind of putting more into, okay, yeah, I do have a problem here. But denial and the culture of being able to acknowledge, hey, I'm in trouble, is just barely, you know, kind of, we're just opening that door to making that really okay for vets to seek help. And unfortunately, the VA hasn't been able to keep up with all the claims. And there's not been enough counselors that have been trained in post-traumatic stress disorder to really and truly deal with it. I mean, and war is certainly something that humans are not geared to face. And so, yeah, there's going to be a high percentage. Women vets have a double whammy in that they are not only exposed to a high level of trauma, just dealing wherever they are, but they're also being sexually abused in the military, unfortunately, with very little recourse. So, you know, they're having to deal with both kind of issues there. So, but yeah, denial is, you know, people come to seeking help in their own time and in their own way. And, you know, there are things that people around them, family, can encourage them to seek help. And, you know, having a support system is certainly helpful to getting, you know, people into some sort of counseling if it's really becoming an issue within a relationship, you know. Doesn't have to be set as an ultimatum, but it you know, that there's certainly ways to nudge people to say, hey, this is really becoming a problem for me in our relationship. You know, I really want you to get some help. You know, I'm feeling you're really struggling here, and I think you can access some help out there. So, you know, I really want to encourage anybody listening that there is help available if you just stay kind of focused on it and get somebody to help you access it.
So when you have, somebody's come to you, you see the symptoms, is this the same, do you only look for these symptoms when you diagnose somebody, or how do you diagnose them? And then, you know, how do you go into treatment after that?
Well, you know, there's, you know, we kind of go over the symptom checklist and we talk about, you know, if there is there been a traumatic event in somebody's life? Is this something that they think they have, or is the, I mean, it would depend on if they came in to me and said, hey, I'm feeling like I have post-traumatic stress disorder, or they are just presenting with this list of symptoms, and that would guide what I ask them next, you know, where, you know, what kind of traumatic events they might have experienced if they felt like sharing it, if they have any memory of it, if they don't. We talk about, you know, I educate them about post-traumatic stress disorder and what, you know, what it looks like, what, you know, some of the, I try to normalize a lot of their experiences and how they've responded, you know, but I look at where it's impacting their life and then we develop a treatment plan. And so, you know, depending on what I'm hearing really sort of dictates what I do next, because a lot of times you do have a co-occurring diagnosis where somebody's depressed or they are drinking too much, or they're doing drugs, or other, you know, other things, to eating, you know, whether those kinds of things have to be addressed kind of in conjunction with the post-traumatic stress treatment. And, you know, so it really kind of depends on what people present with. But once we have established that that is the diagnosis, then we lay out a treatment plan for the person. And cognitive behavioral therapy has been shown to be really one of the better kind. It's a talk therapy, and you know, there's some you know, we also you know, there's a place for medication for really, you know, fairly severe, particularly if people aren't sleeping. Sleep is a real big one that disrupts a lot of folks with post-traumatic stress, and so it's a really important thing to try to stabilize. And it is hard sometimes because of the hyperarousal scenario. So that the cognitive behavioral therapy is an important component to it. That has been shown to be probably the most successful type of therapy, and exposure therapy is a part of that. And that you know, they you know, we walk people through facing and controlling their fears, and we do that through, you know, establishing really safe ways of talking about it. And that also could include mental imagery or writing about it, or visiting the place where the event happened, that kind of thing. You know, we also look at what you say to yourself about the experience, and that's sort of cognitively restructuring that whole story that we tell ourselves about any event in our lives. And you know, I could sit here and make myself feel miserable by what I say to myself about any given thing. And we do that also, you know, when something happens, you know, what you say to yourself about that event will dictate often how you feel about it, you know, how you perceived what happened, whether you believe it was your fault, whether you felt good about how you responded, whether you felt like you had any control. You know, victims of crime are pretty powerless, you know, in that situation. And so, you know, what you say to yourself about that, that whole event really can dictate that. So we look at really kind of shaping what people, you know, looking at whether guilt or shame is you know, whether people are blaming themselves, whether they feel like they're at fault, you know, really looking at things and kind of reframing them and looking at them in a realistic way. So that's another thing that we help people do. And then stress inoculation training is another sort of subset of the cognitive behavioral therapy model that, you know, progressive relaxation breathing exercises, How do you reduce anxiety in your life? What kinds of things do you do on a daily basis to help with that? Meditation is being shown to be greatly effective for people with post-traumatic stress disorder. So that's another, exercise is greatly helpful in reducing stress and anxiety. So, I will always really encourage clients to pick an exercise program that anything that they want to do that gets them moving and hopefully gets them outdoors. And, a big issue is isolation. So, I encourage people to volunteer their time, particularly vets who have had such major, time that were needed greatly by a country, and then they come home and there's nothing, their sense of purpose is gone. And so they have to learn how to create an identity, that helps them feel okay about what they have to offer outside of just the military experience. And so, getting them busy being volunteers, working with animals, I think is great. If you can get a pet, it's highly helpful because it helps you break the isolation, particularly if it's a dog. You take it out for walks, just bonding with another animal. One of the things I'm very excited about doing this spring is doing equine-assisted psychotherapy groups, and one of the groups I'll be targeting is women vets, another is cancer survivors. Horses are great because they mirror to you what your emotional state is. They're great biofeedback machines, and so you learn that you have to be present in the moment when you're working with the horses, and that they really will model your emotional state. So you learn how to really modulate your own emotional feedback system when you work around horses. They demand that of you. So being present, being outdoors, I think is hugely helpful. Exercise, really working on grounding exercises, and really looking at how you're structuring that event in your life. These are all kind of focuses for counseling that I work on anyway. And also in terms of nutritional support, hugely important. What we eat can agitate our state of being immensely. So I look at that with people too. So it's sort of a real holistic approach that I try to incorporate when I work with clients dealing with this.
Okay.
So
the first clip, I'm kind of really interested in how the martial arts are actually helping with the therapy. Have you actually had anyone come to you and basically that was part of the treatment? Exercise is one thing, and beating something up or something is another. And I want to put on Daniel Vina, who just called, and he's a martial artist in Wake Forest, North Carolina. How are you today, Daniel?
Thank you for having me.
So you work with war veterans as well and deal with what kind of martial arts do you teach or do with some of the vets that you work with?
The program is a curriculum designed out of Okinawa called Ishinru Karate. But more importantly, we recognize by our sensitivity training the triggers. So we refer to people like yourself who can help with the counseling. But one of the programs that we offer is being able to recognize the actual problems, whether it's a survivor or someone who suffers from PTSD, especially our military, it has become a real entity, and that we shouldn't treat it as if it were not important. And the programs that we offer work within the community to develop a rapport to try to get information about someone who might be a survivor. So that's the key issue that martial arts in general, because it gets people all together, it's very important that when you promote issues like this in your dojo, people become aware. And people also will open up and start to ask questions, whereas in other environments, they may not want to step out.
Hey, Daniel, do you deal with PTSD with the women, especially with the fact that they want to learn how to defend themselves, maybe right after a rape or molestation or an assault on them?
Survivor programs are very delicate programs, so we can only refer to the professionals, as you say, the counselors. We're not counselors in any way. In our dojo, we are aimed at spotting things like that. So we seek help when it comes to how you deal with that individual, who you speak to, because it is our responsibility, to report that. How you go about doing that is the key to success for that individual. That's what I've learned so far about dealing with survivor programs, especially victims of violent crimes.
Okay.
It's a very delicate subject, and that's why in the martial arts community, again, because we bring people together, there's that trust factor that they won't be violated in that environment. So they may want to speak to you about that.
Okay.
They may.
So basically you refer them to a counselor. You just have to basically train your trainers to spot it so you know why they're acting the way they're acting if the triggers get triggered.
Yes. And then I think what the curriculum does for the PTSD survivor is, yes, it does allow them to get the aggression out, especially when they're with people that they trust. Because in the dojo environment, it's like a brother-sister kind of relationship, and that everybody looks out for one another. So just walking in the door, you know you're in an environment where you can trust the people around you. So that may be a way for them to want to ask a question about it, because it's being spoken about.
Thank you for calling in. And you said that you were also a Blog Talk Radio host. Could you tell everybody how they can listen or where they can listen to you, what the program is?
Yes, it's just called Martial Arts Talk Show.
Okay.
And I'm the host, Danny Venna. And I'm on every night at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Monday through Sunday. And I do, basically the same thing that you're doing for 30 minutes. I have a 30-minute slot.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time and giving us a call and talking about your dojo and how you are basically training your trainers to be sensitive in this matter.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you so much. And so going back to our guest, Christy, have you had any situation in which that was part of the treatment or could be a therapeutic to have someone to maybe go to a martial arts studio or class to just get some of that aggression out?
Well, I have not had an occasion to refer somebody to that kind of program, but I can certainly see the validity of it. It is a place where, the community is usually a fairly close close-knit community the classes are, and you know, people are seen there on a frequent basis. So I would imagine that it could provide a very safe place to let go. You know, obviously, you know, we talk about people feeling irritable and angry and sort of this agitated state of being. And when we do physical activity, whether it's martial arts or tennis or anything that gets us really, you know, moving about, it reduces that level of agitation. And so, you know, martial arts is one of many different things that I could see people doing to get the same kind of effect. If it's a solitary activity versus a group activity, I would encourage particularly people with post-traumatic stress who tend to, at this point, have trust issues, anxiety, tend to want to isolate, may have depression, you know, that it's really important to connect with other people. And so any kind of activity that you can do that promotes that, I would do over some sort of solitary thing, because a big issue is the isolation. And so, you know, and it's hard when you don't feel like getting up and about, but, you know, it's one of those kind of necessary things that once you do, you start feeling better when you start connecting with other people. And so the benefit of group exercise programs, martial arts, what have you, Tai Chi, yoga, any of those meditation classes, while it's not a physical activity that really gets that, bleeds off a lot of that excess energy, anything to break that isolation is usually good. But, yeah, I am a huge proponent of exercise of one form or another. I want to see people sweat, and then that's when you get the good chemicals coming into the system that counteract the cortisol that gets released. And so that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to reduce that. And so martial arts, I say go for it. You know, when you are doing martial arts to the point where you're sustaining ongoing injuries, I have a little question about that. But, you know, these guys are, you know, coming back from horrendously difficult situations, and, you know, they're tough. And but I tend to want to look at that a little bit more closely if there's just ongoing injury out of that program. So that would be my only concern about it. I mean, as a massage
therapist. What do you mean by injury, like physical injury?
Well, this guy was talking about, you know, dislocated this, dislocated that, and kind of laughed about it, because he said the other guys just sort of made fun of him, which in the military,
Mm-hmm.
the military culture, you know, hey, what's a little injury, you know? And so, you know, that's sort of maintaining that macho culture of invulnerability that sort of needs to go away when you're talking about having trouble, you know, because of post-traumatic stress disorder. You have to allow that vulnerability to come out a little bit, or you can't get any help. So, you know, the kind of maintaining or promoting that culture, I have some questions about that. But, you know, I say do whatever it takes to bleed off that anger and that excess energy.
Okay, that's, and you know, I take it massage is also part of the treatment, because we get the endorphins going and so on and so forth. Is massage part of the treatment as well?
I think body work is hugely important in trauma work. You know, you have to certainly establish a rapport with your client or your patient, because, again, trust issues, particularly with women who've been abused, that has to be really handled very gently and with utmost respect for boundaries. You know, you, I'm sure, have had women in your counsel, I mean, in your massage practice, who just absolutely could not relax. Being in their bodies was too painful. And So that's done over time. But again, you know, doing body work, Reiki, massage, any of that that involves stimulating the body's own natural chemicals, the good chemicals, you know, when people are open to it, you know, I think it's hugely beneficial. I mean, we're hardwired for touch. It releases great chemicals in the body. And
yes,
so even when we can't afford to go to a massage therapist or it's too scary for us to do that for whatever reasons or too anxiety-producing, just even little things like reaching out, touching another person when you're talking to them, you know, just any sort of little touch that you can create on your own when you're talking to other people is a, you know, or it's a healing thing to be doing. And so I encourage people to really try to make that a part of their daily activities and lives too. And massage therapy, definitely. Reiki is another very healing, very gentle getting
into
positive
your body. Touch.
I'm sorry?
No, positive touch. So.
Right. Any kind of touch that is a positive energy where it's where the intent is a healing energy is, I think, very, very effective. I saw a post that you did not too long ago about smiling creates certain good chemicals in the brain. And that's true. When we smile, it does release good chemicals. And one of the treatments that is used to get one out of sort of an uncomfortable situation is called the half smile, which...
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you've heard of it or not, but it's sort of an interesting little, you know, thing that one can do, which is just very gently kind of put your mouth into a half smile, not a grimace. This is not, we don't want a grimace, but it's just a very kind of relaxed half smile. And what happens is one of two things, you start laughing because you're doing it, which creates its own chemicals, or just the act of that smile and the muscles used releases the chemical. And so when you're feeling stressed, if you can remember to just do that, you will find that it changes the chemicals in the brain. So, you know, there's also...
Yeah, we were trying to do the half smile and see if it worked.
Oh, and he started laughing, didn't he?
Yeah, pretty much.
We held it in.
So... one way or another, those chemicals get released, you know. So it really does. It's a very effective technique to get you through some certain situations. But, you know, so those are, you know, the medications. I'm not a huge proponent of medications, antidepressants. But they can be used for short-term things. But the side effects are usually pretty bad. But... you know, anything that we need to do to stabilize a person, clearly I don't ever want to minimize it. You know, this can feel like a very difficult thing when people are going through it. So, because you have flashbacks, you're having, you know, heart palpitations, you know, things that, you know, what we try to do is really define what your triggers are and work with those so that you're not blindsided. And that within knowing what your triggers are, you can begin to work with what you need to do when they come up. You know, how do I take care of myself when these triggers happen?
What would be a safe way to find out the triggers? I mean, you don't necessarily want anybody to say, hey, push my button and see what happens.
You know, hopefully you're talking about that within the safety of a counseling session so that,
okay,
you know, you're not broadcasting what your triggers are, but, you know, you begin to identify them and begin to, you know, kind of desensitize yourself around them and learn how to control, you know, your responses to them when they do show up. So, you know, it's really sort of preparing yourself for for, you know, what how am I going to respond to this? What am I going to do to take care of myself when and if this comes up? So, and we do, and we can get desensitized to the event. That's the exposure part of the kind of counseling that makes it less scary over time, so that we can learn how to control our responses to it. And but, you know, I still, I'm a cancer survivor, and I still have very vivid images of my cancer treatment. So not that I dwell on it, not that it comes up, but I can go into a hospital and get pretty flooded with memory. So, you know, that's a trigger for me. And I just recognize it for what it is and take some deep breaths, know that I'm safe in the present moment, and, you know, that I'm not there doing the cancer treatment anymore. I made it through. So, you know, I say some self-soothing kind of statements to myself, take some deep breaths, and know that, you know, that's a sort of one of my triggers. And I've learned to work with it over time, and it's gotten better over time. So, okay. You know, time and distance from the traumatic event definitely helps as well. So,
since we're talking about a little bit of the treatments, have you ever heard of the laughter yoga? I've kind of mentioned that a bit ago on the second installment of the podcast, How to Relieve Stress or Finding Out Creative Way to Relieve Stress. And I've actually been an attendant at one, at a congregation that I was going to, and they wanted us to, to experience what the laughing group does. And it was hilarious to a point that after just 30 minutes of this, laughing at each other, different kinds of laughter, this ho-ho-ho, ha-ha-ha, hee-hee-hee, hee-hee-hee, all that stuff. And my stomach was basically sore the next day. But it felt great.
Yes, laughter is the best medicine. I used humor and laughter a lot in my cancer recovery time, and so I've been exposed to different kinds of laughter treatment protocols, and so this particular one that you're talking about, I have had a kind of an abbreviated experience with, and it is hysterical. And we, you know, laughter just floods our system with great chemicals. And learning how not to take ourselves so seriously, finding humor in things always is a great tactic, no matter what the issue is. But you know, so yes, laughter therapy, perfect. You know, we can
even my anxiety as a host. Every time, I mean, I only do this every 2 weeks, every other Tuesday, but I have this anxiety every single time. And the best way to get rid of it is actually to acknowledge that I'm anxious and to make fun of myself, because my hands are still kind of clammy at the moment, but I'm doing okay.
Well, and you know, and people use laughter, giggling a lot when they're uncomfortable. You know, it's sort of a spontaneous way of releasing that anxiety and being able to kind of acknowledge, hey, I am nervous and this is nerve wracking, and you know, and I'm going to get over it and I need this. And you know, I mean, when you're doing any kind of public speaking of any kind, whether it's over the radio or what have you, you know, most people are going to feel a little bit anxious, you know, and then they kind of settle in after they've, you know, gotten started. But acknowledging what you're feeling, great. Laughing about it, great. All of those are great ways of just handling stress in general. And I know you did your podcast on stress and how to handle it. And, you know, a lot of the things that you talked about, you know, are applicable just in our general day-to-day, how we handle things and how we handle stress. So, but I'm a, you know, great proponent of good nutrition and exercise, getting outside, having some sort of activity that you do with other people, you know, all of those, having support from family or friends is very important when dealing with post-traumatic stress. Being gentle with yourself, recognizing mm-hmm. that you have been through a traumatic situation, and, you know, that it's going to take some time to kind of assimilate it all and make sense out of it. And sometimes things don't make sense when you're a victim of crime or, you know, horrible tragedies. You know, sometimes we have to get to a place where we can't make sense of it. And that's hard for humans because we like to make sense of things and like to have nice, neat little packages that we can digest. But so sitting with that sort of, it's not making sense, is hard for humans, but sometimes we have to get to that place.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time tonight, Christy. Really valuable information. I do, before we let you go and stuff, could you explain to me and to everyone else, what is defining step counseling?
Well, my practice that I have launched or kind of did a remake on here more recently is a solely internet and telephone-based counseling service that I wanted to promote to help people break, you know, mental health services counseling kind of has a bad image at this point. People don't seek it as much, partly because they're afraid that, you know, the expense, the time commitment, convenience, health insurance companies are not required to cover you. You know, people are afraid that it might get back to their employer. I mean, there's still stigma attached. So I've really tried to make my practice more accessible to people this time around using telephone. It's called teletherapy or video counseling. I can do counseling over the phone or via the internet, email. A lot of what I work with, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress, that kind of thing can be done over the phone or via the internet. So really excited about offering this as a way of making counseling more accessible and more affordable and convenient for people. Because I don't have an office overhead, I can really work with people a lot more within their financial ability to pay for counseling. So I'm really trying to reach more people at this point. My equine-assisted psychotherapy groups, I'm going to be doing groups for women cancer survivors, women veterans. We'll be doing a women in depression group and a lesbian therapy group. And all of these groups are going to be starting in the spring. So okay. You know, we'll be posting that on Facebook. So that's under Defining Step Counseling. So anybody interested can check that out and see for upcoming programs that I'll be offering. And as always, I help people quit smoking, and that is my passion in life. I would love to see cigarettes just disappear off the face of the earth. But
yay!
Yeah,
I'm a non-smoker.
Yeah, well, I was a smoker, and it took me tongue cancer to quit. So I have a vested interest in seeing that these things would just go away. So I do offer an 8-week smoking cessation program that's been really effective with people. And so offer that to anybody. I will work with anybody wanting to quit smoking. So that's a passion for me. So that's Defining Step Counseling.
Okay.
And anybody that wants to check out my website can see it at www.definingstep.org. So that's or email me, I think, on your Century Health Talk. There's some contact information as well.
Oh, perfect. Did you actually post something on the Century Health Talk group? That would be best to do, and I can use that to share on my profile.
I'll be glad to do that. I thought I had, but if I haven't, I'll be glad to send that to you. And,
I'm not so sure if you did.
So, but all, you know, I'm love to do group work, and so that's going to be another focus for me. But in the meantime, you know, really wanting people to reach out and get some help. Don't let your fear stop you from doing that, because help's available, and a lot of these issues that people face can be treated. So I want to encourage people to reach out a little bit.
Yes, definitely. Reaching out is really good. I actually had to go through my own therapy as well to be accepting of myself being who I am and what I am. So that took a while, but now I'm doing just fine.
Well, I'm glad you had a good experience with that. I think, you know, I think we all need help sometimes, and it's really easy to get stuck and not see what our options are and not live our fullest life. So you know, hoping to make mental health a good thing, not something that's got a lot of stigma attached to it. I would like for us to rebrand it into something that's good.
Which reminded me, actually, you emailed me one time asking me if I made a mistake when I said post-traumatic stress syndrome. And for some reason, when I explained it to you, I kept seeing the S as a syndrome, just like carpal tunnel syndrome, and that got stuck in my head, and I totally forgot about the D. And you asked me, was that a mistake, or was that in reference to being, you know, the being politically correct or something like that? The war of it, that it's not a disorder or something. You want, oh, and it, you know.
Well, veterans, you know, again, veterans are a sensitive group. That you know, some veterans have taken you know, little caution about using the word disorder. And so when you mentioned syndrome, I was just curious if that was, you know, just a mistake in wording, or whether it was in deference to vets' concerns. So, you know, we all tiptoe around mental health issues like it's, there's just still a lot of stigma attached. And yet, you know, depression is one of the easiest things to treat in the world. And, you know, we're learning all the time what's working better for post-traumatic stress disorder. And you know, we're learning new things about how the brain works and how it impacts our behavior and our emotions all the time. So, you know, I hope that people somehow can transcend this fear that if they go to counseling, it means that they're, you know, the craziest of the crazies out there. And, you know, it doesn't. That it doesn't.
No, I can attest to that. I felt
I'm
crazy. But I'm really,
yeah.
No, I can attest to that. I've gone through some counseling. It actually helped me understand myself and why I was doing certain things, that when I figured myself out, I stopped doing those things, which is kind of hard.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we can really kind of, we don't see ourselves sometimes in how we are being stuck in what we're doing, and so, or how we're sort of self-sabotaging. And so, you know, I think counseling can help us unstick quite a bit. So that's what I offer, with a healthy dose of humor. So I love the fact that you know that laughing is good medicine, particularly
yeah.
in today.
Yeah.
In today's world, things are so serious that if we can find the lightness in it, then it's to our advantage, I think. So.
Well, the thing is that I basically have made several of my clients laugh to a point that some of them actually asked me if I would go into stand-up comic, and my response was, well, even if I stood up, no one can see me. So, because I'm short. And darn, I don't have the rim shot ready for me to hit, so, oh well, but I'm done. Okay.
Well, see, I mean, they're getting all sorts of chemical release being your massage client. So,
yeah, I'm really tired.
Yeah, yeah. But there's just nothing like a good belly laugh. There's just not. So, but you know, people who are struggling, it's hard for them to get to that place where they can see it. So, certainly, don't want to diminish that. That's not the easiest of places to get when you're suffering, and particularly when it's a traumatic experience. So. But that's a goal to work towards.
Exactly.
Yeah. To be able to laugh.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Christy, for taking up the time to call us and talk about this this topic, in which, as you said, people are kind of tiptoeing around because of the fact that there's, unfortunately, we are creating a lot of people who are now suffering from PTSD and not getting enough people get the help that they needed, especially the veterans. So, yeah, hopefully they'll finally get some help. Hopefully the government will actually step up and help out these folks that have basically put their life towards country, and I would hope that the country would help them have a better life.
Well, we can only hope that that happens. I would love to see a huge push in this country to make mental health coverage the same as physical health. At one time, that bill was in front of our representatives, and unfortunately, it was voted down. But mental and physical health parity would help immensely in destigmatizing mental health treatment. Hopefully that'll be done here one of these days soon.
Yeah, me too. I really hope so, too. And thank you, Sensei Daniel, for giving us your part of the sensitivity issue going through in your dojo. Thank you so much, Sensei. And that's it for tonight with Century Health Talk, PTSD with Christy Driscoll. And hopefully next time we'll be back here with, I haven't figured out what we're going to talk about in the next 2 weeks from now, but you'll definitely find out. Join us on Facebook, Century Health Talk Group, or like Century Massage, and we'll also post stuff on there as well. So good night, everybody, and have yourself a wonderful evening.